Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, A Quiet Place Day One director joins us to chat spoilers, and we give our review of Beverly Hills Cop 4.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 313 of Real Blend, a podcast that is not going to fall for a banana in the tailpipe. On this week's show, A Quiet Place Day One director Michael Sarnowski joins us to chat massive spoilers, and we've seen Beverly Hills Cop 4, so stick around for our thoughts on that. I'm joined this week by Kevin McCarthy and Gabe Kovach. Jake is on vacation now. If you're following his Instagram, you'll know that he's in Texas, back home visiting the motherland, which means that he texted us immediately and shared a photo from Whataburger, which is which I know pleased Kevin to no end.
God. Jake and I have had this entire bit for years about Whataburger versus In-N-Out, and I tried Whataburger. We discussed this in the show before. I do not like Whataburger. I thought it tasted like basically like
it's average.
Yeah, it's just average. It doesn't taste like anything special. No. Now, that being said, I probably should give it one more chance. I know he loves it. We needle each other about it. But Jake sends those because he knows it's going to rattle me up, because I always joke that they're called water burgers because they just taste like they've been drenched in like water or something like that. But yeah,
I don't get the whole fascination with it, especially with Texas. When Texas has barbecue, like, why are they even bothering with
it? It's such a regional. It's such a regional thing. I think it's just something you grow up with. Right. It's got to be.
I guess so. Yeah. I'm still waiting for In-N-Out to make its way all the way over to the East Coast.
I feel like they're moving to the Midwest. I feel like I heard there's one opening up like in Nashville or something.
Dude,
we're in the Midwest.
I used to be able to try to get to one on a regular basis, and now I feel like I haven't gone in forever. Kev, have you been in one for a long time?
It's been a while.
It's been a while, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Well, because the easiest one to get to for where we usually go is next to LAX, but that's like the busiest one.
Right.
So it's like,
I'm trying
you have to go out of your way.
I went. Yeah, I mean, like that. You're talking about the In-N-Out on Sepulveda, right? The one like
right next to the airport. Yeah.
That's the one. So my favorite version of that, I love going there and getting a seat outside because the planes land so close. It's so funny you bring this up. I also don't feel like I've been to L.A. a lot this year. I think outside of Challengers and Dune 2,
okay,
the majority of stuff I've done has been virtual.
It takes Zendaya to bring you out, apparently.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, like,
Zendaya or bust.
Even Beverly Hills Cop, I couldn't get out there for, and they were able to let me do virtual, thankfully. But it's been a while. I feel like I've been cheating on In-N-Out. I've kind of been in a McDonald's kick, to be honest with you.
Dude,
here's the thing. So I don't eat a lot of fast food, but this is not an ad by any means. But are there any more?
Yeah.
We're McLovin' it. is there a better French fry, fast food French fry than McDonald's?
No.
It's actually perfect. Yeah. It's a perfect French fry.
But it has to be hot.
Hot.
Has to be good.
Has to be hot.
Yeah, when it's good.
And perfectly salty. But I genuinely think, and they've done some upgrades to their food, their new Big Mac is legit. Like, they've done some like new upgrades. The buns are different. The burgers
science?
Taste different.
Some Big Mac science?
Extra pickles. Dude, when I was a kid, my biggest dream was to figure out what the sauce was in Good Burger. And I always imagined that when I bit into a Big Mac that I was biting into the Good Burger sauce.
Right,
I just
always
imagined it's like some Thousand Island dressing. But yeah, anyways.
My boys
are arguing
that Chick-fil-A has changed their chicken.
I think they have. I think they made upgrades to their sandwich, I think.
Well, they don't like it. They're not.
They don't like the new one.
They don't like the new one. No.
Are you guys pickles fans? Like pickles?
Oh, I hate pickles.
Oh, I like a pickle. I don't like a pickle on a sandwich usually.
I do extra pickles.
Oh, no.
Extra pickles every time.
Horrendous. Yeah. All right. Anyway, that's been your fast food break. Hello, everyone. Are you hungry? I hope you're not watching this episode.
I want pizza now.
Yeah. Oh, we'll get to that in a second. If you're watching us on YouTube, hello, thank you very much. Give us a like and a subscribe. Share the show with a good friend. We're youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. And if you would like a newsletter and an ad-free version of the show, join Real Blend Premium. There's descriptions here that will tell you exactly how you can sign up for Real Blend Premium. No newsletter this week, but there will be one coming to your inbox soon. And I think it's going to have something to do with Deadpool and Wolverine. I hope. Because we're officially in the month of Deadpool and Wolverine. And already I'm seeing like an endless barrage of like potential spoilers. I don't know what's real, what isn't real, you know, what to believe and what not to believe. There was an event in Shanghai that Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman attended. They showed 30 to 40 minutes of the film. And, you know, it's like, we're this close. Can you just not ruin it for us, please? Right. We've been in lockdown this whole time. Can we just stay there? Can we just stay there? Please, God, we're getting so close to watching it. So we'll do what we can to try to avoid it. In the meantime, A Quiet Place and Inside Out, thankfully, are having really healthy runs at the box office. Inside Out, first movie to cross $1 billion this year, which is incredible. Quiet Place opened to 53?
Yeah, 53 domestically. Yeah.
53. And couldn't beat Inside Out in its third weekend, which is...
Dude, just great. I am blown away by how good Inside Out 2 is doing. Yeah. And we discussed this in the show, but one of the things that's interesting to note is with the pandemic, you know, Disney Plus became the home of where Pixar was released. So sure. A lot of people got conditioned to the fact that like that's where Pixar films would just end up. And obviously with the pandemic, you know, being as serious as it was, people obviously weren't going to the theaters, and rightfully so. And I think Disney, at least in my mind, I think we discussed this in the show, probably had to sit back and go, all right, how do we retrain audiences to want to return to theaters for material that will eventually end up on Disney Plus? And like the first Inside Out, I think, made over 800 million or 880 million in its like worldwide run. And this has already obviously surpassed it in 3 weeks. But do these numbers seem extreme to you? Like it seems like I'm like surprised how well it's doing.
I have a theory, and I could be way off, but we're talking about a demographic that doesn't go back to the movies. The teens and the 20 somethings that used to go to the movies all the time. Feels like they don't go back that often. Right.
Right.
Or aren't going out to see, you know, every new release.
Right.
They don't care about Fall Guy. They're not going to go see Bad Boys, Ride or Die. That's not for them. But Inside Out was theirs. They were kids, right? It's 10 years later. They're now in that demographic. So it's not just families, but like, I'm speaking from experience, you know, PJ and Taylor can't wait to go see it, you know, and all their friends are getting together as a group and going, and they never go to the movies. And so I think that's helping, that it's just such a popular franchise from Pixar. And I'm not saying that Pixar, you know, that all those other movies shouldn't have gone to theaters. They absolutely should have. But I think it's harder to try to train an audience to go to the theater to go see a Coco or Soul, you know, movies that are still just as good as these other films. Like Soul to me was my number one movie of the year. But I think it's a little bit harder to convince people to go see something with characters that are not that familiar with. And maybe the Pixar brand has just lost a little bit of shine, unless it's a familiar property. Not
there's
that
no
I advocate
short
them.
This one, right, Sean? There's no short.
There's not. No,
but that was interesting. Is that when did they give that up? I don't mean to cut you off, but like,
no, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Is this the first time there's been a feature without a short before? Did Soul have one, or Luca, or
there was
or Turning Red?
There was an Up short, which was Carl's first date.
Yeah,
and I forget what it was attached to.
Huh? Is that Toy Story 4? Maybe
that's a good question. I don't remember.
I don't know. Okay.
But it used to be a good way for them to introduce or to bring back familiar characters. But
yeah, I was looking at the Inside Out 2, and just kind of like the fact that it crossed $1 billion in 18 days, I'm like, man, that is so fast.
It's
the fastest animated film to ever do it.
Is it the second fastest or first fastest?
I'm reading first fastest according to Forbes.
Okay.
It's the 11th animated to ever hit and the fastest to do so in just 19 days.
Wow.
But I said, what's the fastest to hit a billion? And this is according to Wikipedia, which popped
Endgame.
Up for Endgame in 5 days.
5 days, yeah. Yeah. I think the wow. opening weekend of Endgame was $1 billion.
Well, like, you also remember, days. Do you remember like when Marvel was in its peak and yeah. like every screen had Endgame?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You Dude, know, now it's at least 2
billion.
A little more.
It did 2 billion in 11 days.
Wait, in 11? Oh,
in 20 days. So one more day than Inside Ooh. Out 2, it did 2.5 billion.
Yeah. I mean,
what we'll a time never, to be alive. Never,
that wait a second. And, then it just capped out at 2.7?
Is that where it ended up? Let me see.
I think. That's interesting. Yeah. Just like slowed down. Like it seems like it hit a stop or something.
Sean, how long it. Until it's appropriate for them to re-release Endgame and like take out, you know, do the whole
Avatar
record.
Thing?
Yeah. Do the whole record chase.
And find this
it's
year.
Right at 2.8. It's 2.799.
This year. Why not do it? Who cares?
What is that? What does that make it? This is year five. April was the 5 year anniversary.
There you go. It's like the 5 year blip.
Yeah.
Celebrate the 5 years of the blip. We're going to put Endgame back in theaters.
Everyone's back. So is the movie.
But in the meantime, in addition to Inside Out 2, Quiet Place Day One got off to a really strong start. Biggest opening for the franchise to date.
And unexpected, I would say. I feel like I didn't know what to expect, but I don't think I was expecting it to beat the previous two.
Yeah, that is a bit of a surprise. Yeah, I agree. And it proves that it's a viable franchise. And I
love that.
I don't doubt that they are currently thinking of where they're going to put Quiet Place next or what.
It's a franchise. And so there's that part of it. But it's a great argument. We're always talking about where's the original ideas, where's the new ideas. A Quiet Place was a new idea. And now we're reaping three films in the benefits of living in a new world, you know, within that story.
There's also an element that's introduced in this. And let's put it up right now. So we're going to throw it to Michael Sarnowski. Who is the director of A Quiet Place Day One. We wanted to get him on the show. The way that it worked out was that we got him on opening day, as you're going to hear when we start to have this conversation. So we talk a bit about what it's like to have a big movie that's hitting theaters. And we get into spoilers. So this is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation, a deep dive into A Quiet Place Day One. Spoilers begin now. If you would like to skip to another section, please go ahead and do so. We're going to start talking about A Quiet Place. There's a moment in Day One where Lupita encounters somebody who's like listening to broadcasts and writing down notes and stuff. And they show a globe and the globe seems to has like cities that are marked off. Mm. And to me, I read that as this is where other events are taking place. And I just viewed that as like a little, you know, thumbtack up there of like, here's where else we can go with Quiet Place.
Where
like
does the first two take place? Where does the first one take place?
New England, Maine, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Like it's I like they're up out, in that area.
Like a suburban or maybe rural areas, right?
Yeah, 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 for sure. But yeah, I thought yeah. it was more the New England area. So
because this is the first time we've been in like a major city with this event.
Yes, yeah. correct.
Right. Because and is the day one at the beginning of Quiet Place 2 the same day one that happens in this film?
Yes. Definitely. Okay. And what I forget was like how far the first Quiet Place, when it begins, I thought yeah. it was like day 400.
Like 400 something. Yeah, yeah.
yeah it's yeah, deep yeah. into the process.
Which mm-hmm. I want to give Michael credit for not diving into. I didn't want to know anything about the aliens.
Yeah.
I thought they were going to give more lore into that. And I'm glad they didn't. You just see them come down and we learn about them through the process
yeah, but
of
you
the
know
humans.
One day, one of these movies is going to, that'll be,
I don't
angle.
Want it. I don't want to know, like Starship
maybe
Troopers,
not.
like we go, we start in space with them and we learn their master plan and then they go down. I don't want that. I don't want that.
As long as they keep giving it to interesting filmmakers who don't want that, who understand you know, the pitfalls of that.
That's what makes it so great. Like I don't really need to know the,
but this is what I'm saying. This is what's cool about the concept of A Quiet Place as a franchise is,
yeah.
with small tweaks, you can explore, because what I think is most interesting about this film is the two main characters.
Oh, you know, 100%.
Like everyone's like, oh, we've never seen a horror film. And in fact, Michael talks about this. We've never seen a horror film that's centered around somebody who knows they're dying and
right.
and
yeah.
accepts well, it and wants to die kind of thing.
Isn't that what Saw is?
I don't know.
Doesn't Jigsaw have cancer and he's dying? Yeah. And he's like, Is that the whole bit of Saw?
Could be.
Sort of. I wouldn't say the whole bit. I feel like it's just like a detail
But he's dying and he's trying to give people.
But did that not come up until like the second one or something?
I think, maybe I'm wrong. In 10, he has cancer. I know that. I don't know if it was.
Yeah, I think he dies early. In like the third or fourth. Like
Because 10 takes place between like 2 and 3 or something, or 1 and 2, yeah. I think.
But then when Lupita ends up being Jigsaw in this movie, I was blown away.
Yeah.
And the aliens are just guys in suits.
Yeah. Instead of a cat, they had like this pig rolling around on the tricycle. You want to play a game?
Get ready for a ton of cat talk in this conversation with Michael Sarnowski, the director of A Quiet Place Day One. Reminder, spoilers, if you've gotten this far. Spoilers.
I don't know. I'm still kind of processing it. It's you know, it's exciting. It's relieving. It's sort of like there's a little bit of like a grieving phase of like, oh God, it's done. Like suddenly when everyone's talking about it, I now have like the least control or involvement in it at the same time. Like it's sort of like I did the thing I was trying to do and now it's sort of not mine anymore, but it's also like been my life for 2.5 years. I don't know. I'm still kind of processing what it is.
Wow.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you on opening day. And just to get perspective, that's the day where day one, we're literally talking on day one of your release, no pun intended. But I have to say this, I saw it last night and I've never wanted a piece of pizza more afterwards than seeing this film. I literally left the theater when it was over and went and got 2 slices of pepperoni pizza and demolished them. And so that's a really interesting effect that a film could have on an audience member. Do you remember seeing a film at any point in your life that led you to a food item after you were done watching it?
That's a good question. I was like a specific food item. I'm sure. I mean, I do remember Ocean's 11, watching Brad Pitt eat like hamburgers and just everything in that movie. I just remember, I think that might've been like where I fell in love with food on movie screens, that it was just like, oh God, like there's something about watching people eat in a movie that you just can't fake it. That one has always stuck with me. I can't think of a specific one, but yeah, let's say a hamburger.
Pitt is one of the best on-screen eaters ever.
Yeah, he knows how to do it.
What, like the pizza itself, that scene, like, do you have, like, was it delivered? Like, I'm just curious, like, where you got that pizza from?
The actual physical pizza in that they were eating?
Yeah.
Where did I remember we spent a long time trying to find, like, just the right pizza, and we kind of wanted it to look, like, not crummy, but, like, it's supposed to look like a 3-day-old pizza that they got from, like, a 99-cent slice shop. because the idea is that it's not exactly the one they were hoping for, but it's the one that I could find. I can't remember where we ended up. If I do remember where we ended up getting it from, which I might actually remember, but I don't want to say it because then it's like, I think it was from like a chain spot that it just had the right look of like, that looks like a fine, maybe okay pizza.
Ringing endorsement.
Yeah.
Like it's like the Shake Shack product placement in the movie. He has to cover, make sure that someone didn't sponsor the pizza.
Yeah, but I think we did just like order a bunch of different delivery pizzas and just sort of like we looked at all of them and we were like, this one, that's just too thick. And also we were in London doing it, so finding something that looked like a New York slice was a little tricky. So actually going for sort of some of those chains ended up helping. But I probably shouldn't say where it was from.
All right, we'll keep it on the down low. Michael, I also just got a chance to see the film last night, so I haven't had a chance to do this, but I want to know if I go back and rewatch Quiet Place Part 2, will I find the cat on the island with Jaimin Hansu?
I mean, probably not. But the way that I imagined it was that it's not like we meet every single person on the island. We get a pretty quick glimpse into that society there, so. I don't think Joe Quinn is secretly in there. Maybe when we do the like George Lucas kind of re-release, we'll just like, you know, CG a little Joe Quinn just kind of standing in the background. But no, I mean, maybe who knows? Maybe there is a cat. Let's say yes. Let's say if you see a cat anywhere on that island, that was intended to be Frodo all along.
Yeah, excellent. All right. We'll start that rumor.
And I mean, Sean mentioned this last night, I think, in his Instagram post as well, and I had the same thought. It was some of the best acting I've ever seen from an animal in a movie. And I just genuinely, like, it felt like the cat was literally acting. And I understand that there's people behind the scenes wrangling and doing different things to make the cat appear to be doing certain things. But there are looks that cat gives emotionally,
yeah,
that feel literally like it's emoting.
It's the best cat performance I've ever seen.
Yeah, it sounds a weird question, but what was your direction to it and the people working with it?
I mean, it was a lot of like meow, 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 meow. No, it was, yeah, I mean,
ridiculous, but you know what I mean?
initially kind of the first decision was I knew I really wanted to not do a CGI cat. Like that was, I think a lot of people involved in the project were like, no, we're going to have to at least a little bit do a CG cat. Like there's the stuff that you have this cat doing is ridiculous. And like, we're going to have to like build a computer generated model of this and all that. So step one was like, no, I want to try and get all of this in camera, all of this with the real cat, which we ended up succeeding at. We never had to build a CG model for the cat once, which was really great. So that was the first thing, was to get a real sense of like the presence of that cat and the reality of that cat, was using a real cat the whole time. The other thing was, instead of kind of using like, sometimes they'll use like a dozen animals for the same role. And to kind of get that continuity of character, we just had two cats playing Frodo. You need two so that when one gets tired or is having a bad day, you can swap out the other one. So that was a big decision, was to kind of, it makes our lives a little harder because, you know, you don't have as much leeway if one cat's having a bad day, or if you need to be like, you know, training one cat to do something while you're shooting something else. But that helped a lot. I think it kind of gives it this continuity of character where you like feel like you're seeing the same animal the whole time. And then the other thing was just kind of casting the cat. Joe and Kim they worked for Birds and Animals UK, and they were our animal trainers and did an incredible job. And, you know, they brought like a dozen cats into the office and we met a bunch of different cats. And some of it was kind of like casting a person where you just try and find someone that like is most of the way there. It's like, I can imagine you in this role and it totally makes sense. And I can't wait to see what more you're going to bring to it. So it was just kind of meeting all these cats and finding Schnitzel, who had like just like a certain thing to him. He seemed wise. He seemed older than his years. He seemed like very like astute and sharp, but also kind of aloof in his own way. Like he seemed like he had an inner world going on. And I kind of bought him as like a New York street cat or something. So I think casting was a big part of it. Just finding a cat that like had the right feeling when you looked at it. And then other than that, it was just a lot of trial and error, a lot of training. I mean, they trained those cats for months beforehand, putting them in pools, getting them used to water, getting them used to being carried in a bag, walking on a leash, like all of that stuff. And then also like making the cats comfortable, making them comfortable with Lupita and Joe. Joe and Lupita spent a lot of time with the cats outside of shooting just to kind of like make it so they were at ease and could look comfortable and not like, you know, they were just, why am I sitting here? What's going on? Mm-hmm. And also when you're doing something that a cat doesn't really want to do, which is like floating in a violin case in a flooded subway, they need to be surrounded by people that they sort of trust and feel safe around. So I think it was a combination of all those things. And then just like very specifically, like choosing the shots and actions that we wanted to capture for the cats to kind of convey these characters and these performances. So that was sort of a long answer, but it was a lot.
No, yeah. Michael, I'm glad people are, this is a spoiler conversation and it's coming out post-release, because people are going to be like, why are you guys talking about the cats so much? But it's legitimately important to the movie. Yeah, they're going to see. So last night, I will let you know, my theater was packed and silent, which was terrific. Right. That's the best way to experience it. And the reason why I know it's silent, because there was one shot that you had in there. You have a number of really beautiful shots, but there was one where I went, wow. And I said it like under my breath, but it sounded so loud. It's the shot of,
and went, shh,
shut the fuck up. It's Lupita swimming upstream through the mass of people as they're all heading to the boats. Oh my God. Can you just talk to me about the construction of that shot visually, what you were trying to say with it and how you knew how far to sort of pull back and show the mass of people going through? Cause it really made my jaw drop.
Yeah. The core idea of the movie is let's follow someone that you kind of normally wouldn't follow in a movie like this. This is someone that doesn't even want to survive in some ways. I mean, this a lot of the kind of classic survival disaster movie things you just kind of can't do with her, which was kind of the initial challenge that I wanted to set out for myself, which could have been a terrible idea, but it was like, if I can pull this off and like make a movie about someone who's dying and just wants to get their last slice of pizza, that would be a movie that I would want to go see. And so with that kind of came some of that stuff of like, okay, well, everyone else in the city is trying to escape or rescue people, they would be heading in this direction. This is like that perfect moment to kind of visually convey she's the fish kind of swimming upstream against the current, doing her own thing. And, you know, there were a lot of things that went into it. Like, you know, some of her costume choice is that she has this like bright yellow cardigan that she's wearing the whole time, and everyone else is very grayed down, so she kind of like sticks out from the masses. I mean, as far as like how wide we got in that shot, that was basically decided by how many extras we could have that day. And we needed to, you know, we had a lot. I think we had like 200 that day or something, which sounds like a lot of people. But when you suddenly turn into a big aerial shot where you need to have a crowd moving, so you can't have all those people there the whole time.
Yeah,
we kind of just got as wide as we could without needing to duplicate that crowd. But yeah, I mean, that was kind of the moment that both sets off sort of, okay, this is her journey. It's different from what everyone else is doing, but also it's setting up sort of the threat of that whole sequence, which is like, she's surrounded by people that are, any one of them could make a noise at any moment. And the kind of building pressure of that growing crowd, that like growing rumble, and like the question of when is that going to attract a creature?
It was really cool.
I'm always fascinated because I know Pat and you worked on Pig as well. And in terms of cinematography choices, but narrative decisions behind lens choices and shot choices and the reason why you shoot a certain way. Generally speaking, if you're making a film outside of a franchise on its own, you can choose your aspect ratio because obviously you can go 1.85, 2.39. But I think John started with the 2.39 on the first two. And so you kept that ratio as well. And I'm just curious, like, even though you're staying in that world, do you keep that ratio purposely because you wanted to align with the other two? And in terms of shooting on digital, I think John shot 35 on the first two. I think you shot the Alexis 35 on this one, the digital. I'm just curious, like those decisions and then kind of how you build it into the world. Do you add grain to kind of make it feel like we're living within that same world that he shot?
Yeah. So, I mean, as far as the 2.39, we talked about changing the aspect ratio. I mean, mostly Pat and I love that aspect ratio. It's the one we did Pig on. And we wanted to shoot anamorphic. Pat loves playing with getting like sort of extreme close-ups in anamorphic, like playing with diopters and things like that. So that was, we weren't trying to mimic the previous films in that way. It was a look that we really enjoyed. And we thought for sort of the breadth of some of these scenes, we could sort of capture the scope of the city, but also still get like these like intense sort of personal close-ups. And I mean, Pat's just incredible. I mean, it was the reason I just needed him on this project was he manages to shoot digital in a way that feels very organic, feels very much like film. It's a combination of like the way he lights. He lights very particularly, but it sort of conjures a very naturalistic feeling. So it like often feels like we're just using like available lighting or something. So I mean, all credit goes to him for how beautiful the film looks. I mean, he really knows what he's doing. I mean, as far as digital, we talked early on about doing film for this. Oftentimes it's just kind of a budgetary thing of like that it's going to add too much. But also for this one, we knew we were going to have to be doing set extension and things like that because we had to shoot New York in London, a lot of it on a back lot. So, you know, with all those like blue screens and everything like that, and all the stunts and everything we're trying to pull off, digital just kind of like made a lot of sense for this. We're actually shooting our next project on film. Finally, every time we do something together, we're like, this will be the one on film. And then things come in the way. But now we finally decided this next one's going to be the one on film. But yeah, I mean, just for how VFX was necessary in this project, and also like knowing that Pat would be able to achieve kind of the look we wanted, it just all kind of like fell into place in that way.
Can I ask what the next project is and why that project is going to film versus digital?
Yeah. So the next one is The Death of Robin Hood. It was a script I wrote right before Quiet Place. It was kind of a deal I made with myself saying, okay, if I'm going to go do a big studio movie, I want to have my really personal, specific project that I have total control over kind of in the wings. So I wrote that, and we've been kind of putting it together in the background while working on this. And we cast Hugh Jackman as Robin Hood and Jodie Comer's playing with him in that. And we're going to be shooting that beginning of next year. And I think the film decision, I mean, it came from a few things. One, you know, I made a very tiny movie in Pig, a big movie in Quiet Place, and I wanted to kind of use what I learned from both of those and make something a little more in the middle. And so I think like a lot of that means spending the money in the right ways, having the right amount of time, the right amount of money to do stuff. And one of those things is film. Like on a tiny movie, you kind of film falls by the wayside because it just is prohibitive for the budget. I mean, that would have been like a significant percentage of the Pig budget to do it on film. And then for a big movie, it's sort of like the hectic nature of everything that's going on and all the visual effects lend itself to digital. But then for a movie that's kind of right in the middle, we're going to have the kind of like control and time that we need to be as careful as we want to with film. It's sort of the way we shoot is very filmic in general. Like we tend to really shot list the whole movie, be very specific about what we're getting. We don't do a lot of coverage or do a lot of like single camera setups, and we're getting a very select group of shots that kind of came from Pig. We shot it in 20 days and we just sort of needed to get exactly what we needed and no more. So I think we kind of naturally work in a way that will work well with film. And also the type of story that Robin is, it sounds simple to call it sort of like a reimagining. It's something that both like is a version of this story that I don't think anyone has ever really seen before, but it's also kind of tapping into some of the classic roots of the character as well, like some of the very early roots of the character before he kind of became this playful, steal from the rich, give to the poor kind of iconic figure, like something that's a little more primal. And I think shooting it on film will both bring out a little bit of that like classic Robin sense, but also something like grittier and very present that we really want. So it's sort of a lot of reasons, but mostly we're also just really excited to shoot on film. It would be fun.
That sounds amazing.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
You know, Michael, people will talk about, like you said, doing the smaller intimate film, switching over to doing a franchise picture. And the only way that you could, you know, improve as a director is experience. You have to just do it. So can you tell me a specific way that you are different as a filmmaker because of your experience on Quiet Place and all the responsibilities that sort of came with it versus when you were at the end of Pig, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, there's the obvious things of, you know, I feel like I have a much better grasp on visual effects and special effects and the kind of big scopey things, which, you know, at first I was a little intimidated by, but then very quickly it was like, oh no, this, I'm just going to be talking to people, problem solving. Like it ended up being not some insurmountable thing. And so I feel very comfortable with that. But I think in a lot of ways it was that I realized that I can still, I think when I directed Pig, I had always been a little wary to be a director because I tend to be a little more soft-spoken. I'm more on sort of the gentle side of things. And I didn't think that was the persona that a director needed. I thought you had to be a little yelly, this kind of leader. And I think I realized on Pig that like you can be a soft-spoken leader. You can have quiet conversations and you can be friendly and nice. And it doesn't have to be some intense thing. And then moving on to this bigger project, I was kind of curious to see if I could maintain that way of approaching things on a big hectic studio movie. And I found that I really could. Like you could be on set and it could still feel like a kind of indie set. And like I had people, crew members that had worked on gigantic movies there for a lot of their careers come up and say like, this feels like we're going back to like making an indie movie together. And like, it feels like we're all sort of a family and we're on a team together. So I think that was the biggest thing was I realized, okay, no matter what scale, the scale is going to be decided by what the story is and what kind of story I want to tell. I'm not trying to aim for any scale because now I know that like no matter what scale we decide on, it can still feel the same and it can feel really collaborative and positive. And that was really reassuring. So like, I don't have to be afraid of any different scale because it's still just going to be making a movie with people that I care about.
Awesome.
I'm trying to remember in the first two, if this ever came up, and forgive me if it didn't in John's films, but with dogs, for example, dogs would obviously be barking. I would imagine that when we just assume that all the dogs are dead at some point in this film, because there's no way. And then, certain cats meow, certain cats don't. So I was just curious, like, how you figure out those rules about, like, you know, where the dogs would be, if a cat would meow or not. I'm just curious, like, how those things come up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons for landing on a cat was that, a cat would at least have a shot in this world. A dog, I think it would bark and growl, and like that would be it. So, unfortunately, I love dogs, but that they just wouldn't do great in this world. and a cat, I think, has a shot. Like it was the cat choice was sort of a combination of things. One of them was a character thing. It was, finding that thing that still connected Sam to her city that she had sort of had to leave behind as she went into hospice, and having that cat. I like this idea that, a cat's a very New York-y thing, like this a street cat, a bodega cat. I like that, like, she still had her, like, street savvy New York cat. She was going to go on an adventure, Sam and Frodo heading to the end of the world together. And like, I liked that feeling. But then also, like, I think cats, they're silent predators a lot of the times. Like, we think of them as like the cutesy meowy things, but like, they can be very quiet and hunt. And I figure, if a cat saw another predator like that, and learned that it operated that way, they would be smart enough to kind of keep it down. I also read a study about how, like, a lot of the vocalizations that cats do, a lot of the meowing, is actually a learned behavior that they do to communicate with humans anyways. So sort of in the apocalypse, when they're not trying to do that, they would kind of keep it down. There's a hint that, like, she kind of, Frodo's also sort of a service cat that maybe she's had to train to not make a bunch of noise because she's living in a place with a lot of elderly and sick people. And so there were a lot of reasons, but yeah, I mean, Frodo's kind of excellent at he's a very smart cat and he's good at keeping it down. There's a hint sort of in the beginning that there's a moment in the lobby when they interact with a creature where Frodo like faintly meows, then makes a noise, and then the creatures attack. And in my mind, I'm projecting a bit, but like that's kind of Frodo learning, like, oh, maybe I should kind of keep it down from here on out. And also, like, Sam and Frodo have such a close connection that he doesn't need to like whine or meow to say something to her. They're kind of on top of each other and are doing what they need for each other. So there were a lot of sort of ideas that went into the cat. And also they're just real cute little guys.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, this is a spoiler filled conversation. Let's get into how did you settle on Feeling Good as a song that Lupita would be listening to in her final scene? And if you could also just talk to me about editing that final shot, like what to include, how to finally cut to black. I want to hear your thought process on all that.
Yeah, no, I mean, mostly, I mean, it sounds boring, but a lot of conversations and a lot of experimentation. It was, we knew we wanted that shot to be this kind of one long shot that sort of sweeps you into the city. There's a moment of silence where you kind of like feel the city around her. We tried a lot of different songs. I mean, at one point I had a lot of fun playing with New York Groove, like this kind of like peppy, like triumphant ending. Like I knew I wanted there to be a sense of, although what you're seeing is pretty on paper seems bleak, like this is about her taking agency back and coming to terms with her death in a more positive way than she ever could have kind of hoped for and having lived again. And so like, even though at the end of the day, she's killing herself, you want it to feel triumphant, joyful, kind of life affirming. Like I wanted people not to leave this movie feeling scared or like, oh man, the world sucks, but to feel like, heck yeah, like she did it. Yeah. And so it was really kind of just like trying different songs and trying different moments for the song to come in to see kind of when it kind of hits that right thing. And just kind of, I think we knew the feeling that we wanted to go for. And it was about seeing what kind of conjured that feeling. All the other little decisions of like, at one point there was the conversation of, well, should we do a creature landing behind her at the end, or should we just do sort of cut to black, what's going to happen. We sort of played with both versions and landed on the creature. But then like played with like, okay, how quick, like should it be just like a flash, a moment, and should it be shadows instead? Like we're just kind of, it's a lot of conversations and brainstorming and figuring out We know what we're trying to achieve, what feeling we're trying to achieve, what's going to do that best.
Did you get to test it with an audience at all?
Yeah, we did. And that was super helpful to kind of like, you know, I think we tested a version where we didn't have a creature, and we tested a version where we did have a creature. And there was a difference there between that for people of, I was sort of surprised that like when we didn't have a creature, there was more confusion of like, wait a minute, did she die at the end? And I was
sure.
I think like we've established that like, if you make a sound, you die. But like, you know, I think people don't want to think that she's like in your heart, there's some part of you that's like, oh no, maybe she's going to discover that alien blood cures cancer. And like, she's going to go off and live happily ever after with Frodo and Eric. And so like, you kind of really need to like tell the audience what's happening. Otherwise they'll find some excuse of like, oh no, maybe she was just, I don't know. Which is like, it's sort of sweet that they love her so much that they want to find reasons why she's okay. But then I think when you made it absolutely clear, like, yeah, she's dead, then people could sort of, you gave them the permission to sort of take that for what it was and then feel like, oh, but she like did it on her own terms. And like, I can get behind that.
That's awesome.
My favorite scene in the whole film, and I mentioned it earlier, but it's the scene in the club with the magic trick and obviously the pizza and everything like that. I just found that scene to be incredible. I was just so immersed in that moment. I loved the way he cared for her. I loved the way they cared for each other. I just thought it was a beautiful scene.
Kevin loves magic too, by the way.
I love magic. Yeah. I was just wondering if you could talk about that scene in particular, just the filming of that sequence and maybe how that differs from a tension set piece, because there is such an emotional journey that scene takes us on as an audience. And I just thought that was particularly my favorite scene in the film.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites too. I mean, you know, the whole movie, we're always kind of playing with that ebb and flow of tension and intensity, but then really quiet connection. And there is this kind of running thing of the, like, you know, how do we communicate with each other in this silent world, and sort of the connective power of art and performance. And, you know, there's poetry and the puppetry and the magic tricks. And so I knew that I wanted that scene there. It kind of is like a little bit of a mirror to the puppet show at the beginning. It's this kind of performance that she allows herself to be swept up into. And the way we approached it was, Joe Quinn and I worked with this magician named Luke Germay, who's an incredible magician. And we kind of talked about like what we were trying to like achieve with this moment. And he helped us design that specific magic trick. And Joe Quinn previously like wasn't the best with cards. Like, he struggled to shuffle them, and he just worked his ass off and was like training with those cards constantly. He was doing the trick for set PAs, like really, really, really practicing it so he could master it. So that then when he finally performed that trick for the first time, that was the first time Lupita had ever seen it. And that was when we were doing her close-up coverage on the magic trick. So her reaction to it was like completely authentic. And one thing I talked to him a lot about was like, he knew what the trick was. We talked about some ideas of things that he could play with, but I tried not to micromanage how he was going to communicate this stuff to Lupita. So in performing the trick silent for her, for the first time, he had to figure out how to communicate the things that he wanted her to do silently. And she had no idea even like what, she knew there was going to be a magic trick, but she had no idea like what kind of trick it was going to be, what was going to happen. So it was actually watching the two of them kind of navigate this silent performance together and figure out like, no, I'm telling you to pick a card, and like, okay, I'm putting these, like watching them sort of navigate that gave them the basis for how to do this authentically and how she should react authentically. And I think that's part of, and it was even the way Pat shot it. Like when we shot it, we just kind of were like, okay, we're just going to kind of roam on the stage with them and find these moments and be surprised by them. And I think it creates a real sense of magic.
Yeah. So I'll get you out of here on this, Michael, because you kind of made me think about this, and I was questioning this, and you sort of brought it up. What is the audition process like? What is a chemistry read like for a Quiet Place movie, which are primarily, you know, devoid of long dialogue passages or big conversations that you can have? Are there ways that you have your actors sort of play off of each other quietly to see how they interact with each other?
Yeah, just a staring contest. You just know we didn't. I don't think we did a chemistry read. Partially because you kind of initially the idea behind Joe's character is you almost want to feel like he's barging into her movie and she like doesn't want him there. Like even the way he comes in, it's at a very strange time, structurally speaking. And it almost feels like, oh, okay, we're following the story of this lady and she's going to go get her pizza. And I always saw it as like, you know, she's like a dog that wants to curl up under a porch and die. And then suddenly this like other guy comes in and she's like, what are you like? This is my movie. Like, go away. Leave me alone. So
she's like pointing. She's like, go.
So we kind of, you almost like don't want them initially to have too much chemistry. You want to feel like they're like have no, like totally at odds. And then gradually they kind of discover this unlikely chemistry. I mean, I think it became very clear early on that like they did have that and they cared so deeply about each other. And you really saw that. And I think they also like, they were fascinated by each other. They're both very incredibly talented actors and they loved watching each other perform. And there was this strong sense of like a lot of the scenes are them just sort of quietly taking in the other person's performance. And I think some of that is that like, you know, you have these two talented people just watching each other do something incredible and appreciating that and wanting to understand the nuances of those performances so that they can understand how to react. So I think it was kind of a perfect environment to kind of bring out this quiet chemistry. And yeah, it worked better than I could hope for. They had a wonderful dynamic.
They really do. Michael, you have a very special film and we thank you for taking the time on your opening day to sit down with us. And
thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Oh, great. We'd love to have you back on sometime. You.
Yeah. Good luck with the new one.
I would love to.
Yeah. Let's,
hey, good luck with that newcomer, Hugh Jackman. I hope he's, he lives up to it.
I'll get him into shape. I mean, you know, I think he'll be okay. We'll see. No, he's incredible. Thanks, guys.
We want to thank Michael for coming on to Real Blend. Terrific guest. Welcome back anytime. I cannot wait to see what he ends up doing with Hugh Jackman in that Robin Hood film. That sounds incredible.
Yeah. Was that news?
No. We've known about that film and we knew that Jackman was cast in it. And he's got Jodie Comer in it as well, too. Mm-hmm. It's news that he's shooting on film.
That was cool.
I was gonna say there might have been some details that we didn't know, but
absolutely. That was cool. Yeah. I want to run something about the fact that he's doing that. I also was blown away by how he directed Pig and then transitions over to a big franchise picture, and he talked very candidly, I thought, about, you know, being a director who starts with a smaller, you know, indie film, a Nick Cage driven character film that gets a ton of praise, and then him sort of challenging himself and saying, I'm gonna go over and try a franchise picture and not losing who he is as a person. Like, he's a soft-spoken guy and talked about how he learned that you can be that, you can still run your set the way you want to run your set and have conversations with your creatives and do all that. And now he's very, he didn't use the metaphor of the one for them, one for me kind of thing, but I feel like he's very truly going to do that. And I admire him for it. Kev, you didn't get to talk about Quiet Place on last week's episode. Where do you said this is as good as the first one? Is that where you rank it?
No, I'm not as good as the first one, better than the second one.
Okay.
Gotcha. But actually the more I think about it, it is becoming slowly as even as the first one for me. I also just really preferred the emotional drama of this film. I liked following this character Lupita plays and then her meeting with Joseph Quinn's character and kind of their relationship as it blossoms throughout the story. And then the danger of the cat. The cat really is a perfect tension building tool.
That's great.
It's an incredibly well executed tool to have for this type of film, because you're dealing with an animal that has no idea what's going on, even though I think cats are smart and I do believe that they can learn but not the specific nature of the sound thing. But inevitably those were the most tension filled moments for me. It was like, oh, the cat's running away. What are they going to do? That was like, that to me was the most like, I was like more intense than I was about some of the humans.
And he's so right about dogs. Like, dogs would just get killed instantly.
Right. Are we talking spoilers still or no?
Yeah. We're still in spoiler conversation. My
favorite scene in the whole film is when Joseph Quinn brings her that pizza and he writes Patsy's Patty's? Patsy's?
Patsy's.
Yeah, on the box. And then they eat it together. And he does the magic trick. And I don't know, out of every scene in that whole film, that's the scene that resonated the most with me. Because he was such a giving, caring character that wanted her to at least have a good remaining days of her life. Mm-hmm. And then for her to be then fully reconnected with her father in a way. And, but I thought the ending was brilliant. Like the way that, like he was talking about in an interview, how the monster comes down behind her, and
yeah.
It's so smart. And I was very impressed with Joseph Quinn. I was very impressed with Lupita. Obviously she's an incredible actress. I thought Alex Wolff was great. I thought Jaimin Hansu was great. I thought it just really kind of worked, and it was a pleasant surprise for me. I thought the sound design was remarkable. I thought it was shot well. Some of the CG I thought was a little off, which is strange because I think the first one cost $17 million and it made like 340 mm-hmm. million, I believe, at the box office. This one cost reportedly, I think, around 65 or 70 from the numbers that I've seen. Correct me if I'm mm-hmm. wrong, if that's not right. And I would still argue that the first one looks better in a way. Sure. And I think the next one, the second one, was a bigger budget, a bit more, but it didn't make as much as Quiet Place One. I think Quiet Place One did 340 and the second one did 297 or something like that. It was like almost $50 million shorter. But this had a very big opening. I don't know what its legs will be. I'm curious how that's going to be, because Despicable Me hits theaters this weekend. And then that opens talking actually about, yeah.
like Inside Out 2 doing so well. Like
yeah.
the executive producers on Despicable Me must be salivating.
Oh, wait, do you don't think they're worried about like I think Despicable Me 4 might suffer from the Inside Out.
I don't know, because I think the takeaway of Inside Out is that families are craving, you know, entertainment. That they want something to be able to do. And if they all yeah. went to Inside Out 2, they're looking for the next thing.
Yeah. I don't see Despicable Me 4 doing as good as Inside Out 2. I don't think Despicable Me 4 gets to.
It might not do as well. Million.
Yeah.
It might not do as well.
I don't know.
But, you know.
I mean, but that franchise is massive, right?
Yeah, huge. I mean, they've made over.
It has two openings over $100 million.
What did 3 do? 3 was like a little less, right?
3 did 72.
Yeah.
The first one did 56 opening. 2 did 83. Minions movies, both the Minions movies were over 100.
Over 100 for the Minions?
Yeah.
Wow.
Debut.
And those are side characters from a Despicable Me movie, yeah, which is yeah, crazy.
Let's see what Minions did total.
But if you get a movie that has, like, in real life, in live action, Steve Carell, Will Ferrell, and Kristen Wiig, like, that should destroy.
I know.
They have to do animation in order to get powerhouse stuff. Let me go back to Quiet Place for a second. I think what's going to power these, as many of these as they do, is the characters and the actors that they get in them. Lupita and Joseph Quinn are incredible. Obviously Krasinski and Emily Blunt, you know, are fantastic. And that Millicent Simmons, it was a breakout in the first two mm-hmm. films. She's a terrific actress. It's Killian. It's your boy Killian before Oppie.
I know.
Before you know, like Oppie. And Jaimin Hansu, like, as long as they continue to just cast strong actors and develop, you know, three-dimensional characters in this world, it's almost like the aliens and the attack are inconsequential. It's all about like what sort of happens around the people as the stories are playing out. So yeah, I'll be curious to see the legs for Quiet Place 2. So we'll see Quiet Place Day 1. We'll see how that does moving forward. It will not have to compete at the theaters with Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, because Netflix refuses to put that in theaters. And
do you think that would have done well?
Yes, I do.
Like realistically, like what, $50 million you think opening weekend?
I think it could have done close to Bad Boys numbers. I think there's enough audience.
You
could have
done Quiet Place numbers? But what did Maybe Quiet not. Place do? 53?
Well,
so you could do Quiet Place numbers.
So as we talk about Axel F, this is our official review of Axel F. What could it have done? I don't know. Everything is nostalgia nowadays. Everything is getting, you know, the old band back together.
Right.
Bad Boys Ride or Die being the latest example of it. I could not shake the fact that I just don't need to see old versions of these characters that I liked again. You know, there's no getting past the effects of Father Time. And Eddie Murphy was 23, I think, when he made the first Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
And he's in his 60s.
Or younger than
now.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in his 60s now. He's still funny, you know, but is he an action star? No, he's not. I'm sorry. Judge Reinhold and the guy who plays Taggart. I'm blanking on his name.
John Ashton. Yeah.
They just look old. They just look old. Everyone just looks old. Kevin Bacon looks old. You know, like, I get the hook of bringing everybody back, but I think it plays against it in the fact that I'm just watching old actors trying to get through an action movie. And, you know, the action genre has changed. You know, the action genre is Monkey Man now, you know, with Dev Patel just crushing people. John Wick. Yeah. Keanu doesn't look a day over, you know, 22 still at this point. Did I enjoy it? I had some fun with it. It was fun. Would it have done well in theaters? I don't know, because it bothers me too that all Netflix movies, not every single one of them. Obviously, if someone like Fincher shoots, it's going to look like a film. They all look like television. They all have a sheen to them. They have a gloss to them.
Horizon looked like a TV movie.
Yeah. This stuff
just did. It just did.
But Beverly Hills Cop in particular, I'm looking at, like, somebody's going to have to do a side-by-side of Tony Scott's Beverly Hills Cop 2.
I mean, it's Tony Scott.
But then find the next Tony Scott, right? Like, find someone who's going to give it that grain, you know?
That would be ideal, but I think, you know, at the end of the day, you're right that this nostalgia franchise, what are they called? The legacy sequels?
Legacies, sure, yeah.
Is a genre now. And that's they're just what's the minimum? Not that they didn't spend enough, but just like they're not trying to do this like masterpiece.
Yeah.
They're just trying to do this, you know, it's just a studio movie at that point.
There's a big element, like, so you dedicate, I'm gonna say roughly 50% of the runtime of Beverly Hills Cop of just, hey, here's that guy again, you know?
And it's
Billy, and it's all these characters that it's like, you got to get Axel to interact with each of those throughout it.
You know what might be the saving grace of this genre in a way? Maybe this doesn't qualify, because there were images released for Gladiator 2.
Okay.
And I was a little worried that too much of it was going to be a nod to, remember when he used to, you know, he used to rub his hands in the dirt, you know, like we got a shot of him rubbing his hands in the dirt like that guy. You know, like it's a little tinge of like, don't be that.
But we're just trying to entertain you, Gabe.
Exactly. And Ridley Scott. Yeah.
Are you not entertained?
But that is to your point of like, get, and it's actually, it's kind of ironic that it's Ridley Scott and we're talking about Tony Scott, but that you saying get Tony Scott, Gladiator 2 feels like it put the person is in charge that's going to make what feels like a legacy sequel in a way of like, let's make this its own good movie versus, hey, it's this guy, you know?
Oh, like, let me tell you what movie I'm terrified of because of this. Beetlejuice. Oh. That movie is teeing up to be.
It looks good.
Did you see it's going to, is it Venice?
Opening Venice.
Out of competition, though. Out of competition, they said.
Clayton Davis, who is the awards pundit for Variety, has been saying for the past 2 weeks that Beetlejuice is an awards movie.
What if it's a masterpiece? What if it's like, it's like Godfather Part 2 or something like that?
Is he due for a great movie?
Well, he has Keaton in his best supporting actor.
That's pretty good.
Wait, why is he supporting?
He's probably not in the movie that much.
It's like called Beetlejuice.
It is, but even like the first Beetlejuice was a lot of the family.
Yeah,
that's so
a lot of Winona. It's a lot of Catherine O'Hara.
That's like Silence of the Lambs, though. He's in the movie for 19 minutes. He's leading actor.
No, he was supporting. I think
he was supporting.
No, Hopkins won
supporting.
No, Hopkins won lead.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
16 or 19 minutes in the movie.
Someone tweeted something like the other day, and they're right, and they're like, you know, Hannibal Lecter really didn't help with the Buffalo Bill investigation. And I read that, and I was like, that's really true. He kind of didn't. Oh, my God. Did you see the trailer for Long Legs?
That looks insane. Dude. I've been staying away from trailers. I heard it's really scary.
it looks like a new Silence of the Lambs. It's coming out in July.
I might go see it Monday night. I really want to see that. It looks really good.
Spicy. Kev, you didn't talk about Beverly Hills Cop.
Is that Micah Monroe?
Micah Monroe, yeah. And Nick Cage.
Yeah. I actually have not seen the full trailer. I've only seen like stills.
Okay. Don't watch it.
Okay.
Don't watch it. Just go.
You haven't seen the film yet.
I haven't yet. No. And the trailer doesn't even ruin anything, but I'm saying just go.
All right, maybe I'll go Monday night.
All right. What'd you think of Beverly Hills Cop?
In terms of like Beverly Hills Cop 4, I was concerned about it at first because of all the nostalgia you're talking about. The aging thing doesn't really bother me as much, but it feels very formulaic. Like they're just plugging into, let's basically remake the first one and second one in a way, or like we'll do some same bits and like the same jokes. I get it, but it's almost as if they're like, it's like a parody of itself in a way at times. But I did like Axel being a father. Mm. I thought that was a really interesting emotional tidbit to have, where you have a character who's made decisions in the past three films, and then now you're seeing him make decisions as a dad, and kind of how that affects the way he does his police work and everything. I thought Joseph Gordon-Levitt was really good. I thought he actually worked well in the story. But overall, I just was not a fan of the script. I thought it felt too long at times. It felt like it was just, I don't know. I rewatched the first one recently. I'm like, I'd rather just put that one on. I think, you know, it's so funny. Like, it's not funny, but the beginning of the first one, I forgot how brutal the beginning of that movie is. The guy who plays Mike in Breaking Bad, he steps up to that and he kills his friend.
Best friend. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That scene is horrifying.
Yeah.
Like this is an action comedy. And I forgot how dark that scene was. Like, yeah, it was like a really, like there was no mercy at all. They just killed the guy.
Yep.
And I remember like that being a really interesting launching pad into what this became, this comedic film or comedic action film. But I don't remember that movie.
Yeah, there was danger.
There's
actual danger, yes, in movies.
Actual stakes.
Yes.
Real stakes. And so, yeah, I found it to be unnecessary, uninspired. I wanted it to be great. It just kind of felt like, with Eddie Murphy doing Coming to America again as well, it was just like this, it was an unnecessary retread of the material that I didn't need.
Yeah.
And I think had they made Coming to America, you know, the second one, like earlier on when it was like still part of like, you know, the filmmaking, and everybody loved that movie. Everybody still loves that film, but it just was too late, I felt. And so this one feels too late. Like you said, it feels like Netflix was like, okay, how can we, or whoever made it, I know Netflix is releasing it, but it feels like they were like, okay, how can we tap into something that's nostalgia? Maybe this will work.
It was in a folder of options.
Right. It feels like a business decision, not a storytelling decision.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. With all of these legacy sequels, it's like, if this person agrees to come back, if Eddie says yes, we're going to figure out how to make a movie work around him.
I mean, they probably paid him.
You know, it's funny.
We keep so much money.
We keep talking about Tony Scott. The one that did it best was Top Gun Maverick, ironically enough.
That was a phenomenal sequel. You know, how did they get that to work? Yeah, how did Top Gun Maverick should not work.
Let's keep making Tony Scott movies, I think is what we're saying. Tony Scott.
I think
had
they worked
it,
on it year, for years.
Oh, yeah.
I think they worked on it for years and years and years to get that script.
Well, and Tom Cruise was definitely, well, we have that story with Tarantino talking about it, but like Tom Cruise is very much like, I don't want to touch that, until there was a story that was like, hey, what if we told this story? Not
sure.
Hey, check this out. People will like it if you're Maverick.
Right.
When I say find the next Tony Scott, like, believe me, I understand that's really hard.
Yeah.
But like, I think Joe Kaczynski, they found someone who, you know, can direct the hell out of a picture.
Right. And it was his idea that he was like, I want to make this.
Yeah.
You know.
So. And they started the Glenn Powell movement.
They started the,
at least
they definitely gave it
heavily.
A boost. They gave it a boost.
All right, we're going to throw it to a quick ad break, and on the other side, we want to talk about some things that we have been watching recently that you guys should be paying attention to. And we are back. Okay, so primarily what I wanted to talk about is The Bear, which dropped its full season of the full episodes of season 3. And we are, I think Michelle and I are 2 episodes away from the end. I'm not going to discuss any specifics or any spoilers, so you can listen to this safely. But what I will say is please be watching The Bear. I mean, I legitimately think that it's one of, if not the best shows on television. There's two episodes to go. It could completely shit the bed, but I personally feel like this is the best episode of the show. But it takes sitting with the first two seasons in order for all of the tiny things that happen over the course of this season to matter. You should be invested in the characters. If you're not, if the show doesn't work for you, I totally understand. But we are 100% in, and it's just, to me, it's good cry television.
Sean, it's not unbearable.
It's not unbearable at all, Kev. It is. Well done, Kev. It's not grisly.
Welcome back to the show this week.
Thank you. Very, very much.
It's so damn good. And a friend of mine tweeted this also, and he was like, I don't understand how people can binge this show because
it's too intense, right?
Yeah. By the end of every episode, you're so emotionally drained in a good way, in a really good way, right? Like, tough things happen to the characters, but you're invested in their journey. And there have been one or two episodes where Michelle and I would look at each other and be like, okay, we have to keep going. Like, we just have to keep going to see what's going on with the story. But there's other ones where you get to an end and you stop and you think like, all right, I gotta let that sit, you know? And it's tough to navigate. Like, if anyone's, but I haven't been spoiled on anything. Like, no one's really taken to social media. No one's really blasting much of anything. So that's been good. And we're two episodes to go. So I highly, highly, highly recommend The Bear. Gabe, I know you said we were running out of time, but just briefly, can you tell people how much you're enjoying The Boys?
Oh yeah. So I finally caught up. I hadn't started the season until earlier this week. And I binged right through the first five episodes that I think that are out now. And Sean is not caught up. So I'm also not going to get into specifics because I know he's excited about it. I know he really likes that show. As he should. All I have to say about it is that it's incredible that this is the fourth season and it feels like it's swinging higher and harder than it ever has. That's and cool. is still hitting like home runs. Like, whether it's the just you're coming in understanding that like they're going to do the most ridiculous, heinous thing because that's the playground and sandbox they've built for themselves. And that's so fun. Or the sort of like social commentary, political commentary, real world commentary. That like they've been able to make this world where they can be on the nose and it works and is not like distracting and it doesn't even feel like it's too preachy is the word. I feel like there's a better word than that. It just feels like it's living in its own world and it's able to get away with things that shows just can't. And this season for me is still firing on all cylinders. I haven't seen Gen V yet and people have been recommending it. It's a spinoff.
That's a
show.
Side show. Yeah. Yeah.
Which takes place at a college, which is right up my alley. Like the idea of like, you know, like a superhero high school, superhero college. Like,
yeah,
that sounds awesome. I've heard it's really good. And then this season starts to bring in some of the characters from that. I don't think it hasn't affected watching it, but it's gotten me reinvested in the franchise and wanting to go back to it. So if you haven't caught up on The Boys, this season is really good so far. Right. And I'm loving it. Right. And I can't wait for Sean to finish it so I can or catch up so we can talk about it.
As we get out of here, head to the comments down below and let us know your favorite Eddie Murphy movie. Kevin's, I know, is Nutty Professor.
First of all, it's a masterpiece and he should have won Best Actor. And I think he agrees. I remember interviewing him. I mean, now I want to clarify, masterpiece is, you know, a word you shouldn't throw around lightly. I haven't seen Nutty Professor in years, but it had a pivotal moment on me as a story, Kev, as a filmmaker. Yeah.
Should the family fart scene won the Oscar for best song?
I'm being serious. Like, so
is that music to your ears?
I'll keep this brief, but like, I remember interviewing him for Coming to America and I asked him, I was like, why don't people take comedy so like, you know, more seriously? He goes, and he was basically saying, cause he got nominated for Dreamgirls. Right. And he's like, he goes, people always kept talking about this look I gave in Dreamgirls. And he was like, but did you not see me playing every person at the table except for the kid? Yeah. And like the filmmaking behind that, for people who aren't familiar, like he's essentially sitting next to nobody with a green ball and he's doing all of his dialogue and then has an earpiece in for what he recorded from the day prior and then does the other side of the dialogue. So he's doing like the grandma talking to the father, and he's going back and forth, and then the whole thing is edited together, and it looks as if it looks incredible. It does. That scene looks unbelievably great. Yep. Go back and watch that scene again.
No, it's great.
It's actually like incredible
and
filmmaking.
He knows the work that goes into it. Like that's the thing.
But because it's farts, people just don't. They'll go, yeah, it's stupid. Whatever. That is genuinely like brilliant filmmaking.
It did
that
win.
Particular.
Oh, no,
did
no,
it?
Let me see.
Visual effects.
It won.
Makeup.
Rick Baker and
Rick Baker David did that.
Yeah, for best makeup. Yeah.
Wow,
yeah. Dude. Which you're making a point of.
I think he did Come Into America too.
Editing. I think so too. I feel like it should have.
Oh, the editing.
A nomination, yeah. At least in some.
But I mean, like, this is 96. How are you getting a shot that looks so good of six people or so sitting there?
It's practical.
And they're
practically taking.
I know,
the time.
But like, how do you do? They drop them in, Gabe. Like,
I think everything's locked. I think everything's locked down. So they just like split the frame, and I don't remember the details of the scene enough. Like how much they.
If it's a wide shot and they're all and all the characters are there.
Oh yeah,
they just composite. Like, yeah, cut Photoshop.
It's just individual shots put together. Yeah.
To give you an idea of how so, we haven't run Jan de Bont, right?
Not yet.
No.
Okay, we have Jan de Bont coming up on the show.
Oh, do we?
And he is talking Twister. And I'm watching
that. Look up that IMDb page, folks.
Yeah, yeah, right,
exactly.
Dude, and the pop quiz hotshot thing he confirmed was Whedon. I'd always heard that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, Whedon did a bunch of punch-ups.
But I never knew that was for sure that was his line.
So I'm watching the behind-the-scenes stuff on Twister, on the first Twister. And there's a moment where... a house rolls into the middle of the road and their pickup truck drives through it. Right.
Yeah.
Probably 7 or 8 seconds worth of footage. Right.
Yeah.
Of this truck going into the house through the rooms of the house and then out the other side. And I watched the behind the scenes of how they constructed like 5 or 6 different sets to represent each room of the house to just capture the truck as it went through another element of the house, like up the stairs into a master bedroom. Like, so the stairs was a set, the master bedroom was a set, and it took them 2 weeks to film it.
Wow.
You know, to film 7 seconds of it.
I was going
to
say, and it's
but
just...
we used to be a nation. You know, we did that and it looked great. And now we just CGI it all.
You know,
and
dude,
it's terrible.
We've defunded NASA, Sean.
Rob Lowe told me this story about Francis Ford Coppola on The Outsiders, where like they took an entire day just because Francis Ford Coppola wanted a camera to go through a wall in a house.
Yeah.
And so like he came up with it on the day and then just said, all right, we're going to tear this wall down. So everyone had to sit around for like 8 hours and then they get the shot. But that's not happening. He goes, Rob Lowe's like, that's not happening anymore. This bit, like, you know, I mean, unless you're Chris Nolan.
Yeah.
Which
I will say that is a part of it. When it happens, it does feel really special in that it becomes an event film. It does create this sort of aura around a film.
Sure.
Whereas at the time, maybe it was what it was, but that was just how you made movies. Well, that's what you had to commit to that level.
The other day I was interviewing Channing Tatum and Scarlett Johansson because I was asking them, for people who aren't familiar, Fly Me to the Moon is basically this story about Johansson's character gets hired by NASA as like a marketing specialist to fake the moon landing so that when they cut to the feed on broadcast, they cut to a set versus the real moon landing in case something goes wrong and makes America look bad. And so the set looks so realistic that you can't really tell the difference between the moon and that because the broadcast quality wasn't great back then, etc. So I asked them each like their favorite movie sets they've ever been on. And like, what was a set that was so realistic, kind of blew your mind? And she was like, the first set I ever went on. I was 8 years old. It was Just Cause. With Sean Connery.
Really?
And she was saying about how like when she was 8, she walked on the set and everything was like built. They built like everything. And then she was like, and then Scorsese invited me to the Hugo set and I got to see these massive trains. And then she talked about Jojo Rabbit and how like they built out the houses and everything. And then she's answering that. And then Channing goes, he goes, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I feel like I got into this business. I'm paraphrasing him. I got into this business when they stopped really building sets. I'm like, he goes, maybe White House Down when they built the White House. And I was like, and it kind of gave me this juxtaposition between like, She's been acting since she was 8 years old.
Sure, yeah.
And right. he doesn't have a great memory of a practical set that he's worked on.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, wow. And they're not that far off in age, I don't think. I mean, I think she started so young.
She just started so young, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're still both very young, of course, but like, I don't think they're that far apart.
But that's
in
how
age,
the industry has changed drastically. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she said she was like, even like the Avengers sets were amazing to me, even though those are CG. I think the old
MCU
films,
you see how much of like that in-game, the portal scene, how much of they actually did put on the ground and sort of extended the set. It's still
the earlier
incredible.
MCU stuff I thought was more practical than it's become. Like Quantumania was probably the one that broke me. I'm like, this whole thing feels like a video game.
Not, and I'm wearing my shirt right now, but like if anyone's paying attention to any of the set photo stuff in that Superman's shooting all around Cleveland was, because of the Russos, the whole Battle of New York was shot in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And from Avengers 1. And all the Winter Soldier stuff when he fights Bucky is downtown.
Yeah, that was in Cleveland.
They shot on location.
On that
in
bridge.
Places.
That's why when I saw the bridge scene in Winter Soldier for the first time, it was the most grounded action
scene. That
scene
was set in Cleveland, wasn't it? Weren't they in Ohio?
Oh, maybe.
But that whole scene when he jumps on the hood of the car and like that whole sequence. Mm-hmm. It was before that, The Dark Knight was the only film I'd really seen in a long time. You know what's funny? The other day this is total sidetrack. I was rewatching Blade 1 the other day. And if you stop to think about that movie for 1 second, and when it came out, it was R-rated superhero at the time. Like superhero films weren't what they are now. And that movie crushed. That movie was awesome. Steven Dorff was a great villain. Obviously, Wesley Snipes was incredible. The opening scene when they go to that nightclub and starts raining blood from like Slayer style. Like that movie is so far ahead of, like, you got to think about like the superhero genre now. Everything is superheroes.
Yeah.
And for a studio to green light Blade and to do well and it be R-rated is a really, really, I feel like that story should be told more often.
This is why they talk about, like, why can't Marvel crack the new Blade with Mahershala Ali? They're
because
like,
I think
you have Mahershala Ali, two swords and vampires. Go.
Yeah.
What do you need to do?
I know,
is
but
it
I think Blade
forever?
Blade was almost made in a vacuum in a way, because they're like before like that was, you know, Deadpool later on became that R-rated.
But I also think that Blade is a character that a lot of people go, oh, that's a comic book character. Like, I think sometimes people just think that that's just a great movie that came out. Like,
because even like Spawn was PG-13. The Tim Burton Batmans were PG-13. I'm trying to think of another R. It was Darkman. Is that considered superhero? That's Sam Raimi's movie. I don't think that's a superhero movie, but I guess Blade was really kind of, it deserves more credit for what it did. It kind of paved the way for a lot of stuff that we don't talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's cool. And it also paved the way for Blade 2, which
Blade 2 is awesome. You know who directed Blade 2?
Hell yeah.
Guillermo del Toro, right?
Guillermo, baby.
Right. And then our buddy Ryan Reynolds was in Trinity, the third one with Jessica Biel.
Yeah. Which is,
I haven't seen
Alba.
Three in
Alba
forever.
Or Biel?
I think it's Biel.
I think Jessica Biel.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then was Ron Perlman in 2?
I think so.
I would assume because it's Guillermo.
But the first thing I think about when I think about Ron Perlman is Ron Perlman in Alien Resurrection.
Really?
With Winona Ryder. Isn't that Winona Ryder?
Yeah.
Was like I remember his face because the way they shot his face in that movie, the lenses were like distorting him and it was cool.
Anyway, we have sidetracked.
He has a face though. He has a very good face for cinema.
He does. Tell us your favorite Ron Perlman face in the comments down below. In the meantime, follow us on social media. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Talk to you guys next week. Sean Levy. Come on, Sean. Come on the show. Please.
Hey, Sean, you know who started the Glenn Powell surge?
Who?
Who?
The Dark Knight, baby. Chris Nolan.
Rises.
True.
He was in Rises.
Yeah,
true.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It all goes back to Nolan.
Everything goes back to Nolan.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.